Each day during this retreat we have Dhamma readings in the morning time, and a day or two ago we had a reading that comes to mind from the Dhammapada, one of the most well-known, well-loved collections of the Buddha's teachings. And this is a verse that Ajahn Sumedho used to recite very often, and also was one of the causes for him choosing the name of his monastery, Amravati. It says, mindfulness, heedfulness is the path to the deathless. Heedlessness is the path to death. The heedful never die. The heedless are as if dead already. This is a punchy punchy little teaching, very compact and potent, very direct and inspiring, challenging. And the word Amravati means the deathless realm, and Ajahn Sumedho was inspired by that concept, that quality of deathlessness, and he particularly felt it was appropriate. Amaravati Monastery opened up in the early 80s, 84, 85, and it was a time when there was a lot of talk in Europe about the threat of nuclear war and a great deal of anxiety about destruction. The arms race was still going full throttle between the Soviet Union and the US, and so there was a lot of talk of death in the air, and that was one of the reasons why Ajahn Sumedho said that he felt it was very important to contemplate deathlessness and to bring signs of, or indications of, the quality of deathlessness, that which is free from the realm of birth and death, into the group consciousness, to bring awareness to that. So he ended up settling on that the name Amravati as the deathless realm, as the name for the new monastery. Actually, when it was the place was first, the idea for it was first launched. I was living up in the north in a small branch monastery up near the Scottish border in Northumberland, and when I heard of the name that Ajahn Sumedho had chosen, we heard the idea, that there was this idea of getting this new place to be a retreat center and a bigger place for the nuns and a teaching center. I was reading a compendium on the life of the Buddha at that time, and when I heard the name that Ajahn Sumedho had chosen for this new place, Amravati, I thought, well, that's a bit cheeky, because I just read the beginning of this book. It starts off by saying four incalculable periods and 100,000 eons ago, in a city called Amravati, there lived a Brahmin called Sumedho. And then the Brahmin Sumedho then goes off and meets with, he leaves the household life, becomes a yogi, and then hears about the presence of Dipankara Buddha, and goes off to meet Dipankara Buddha, and then is, before Dipankara Buddha, he makes the vow to realize Buddhahood himself for the sake of all beings, and as he meets them, he makes this vow or this aspiration, states this aspiration in front of Dipankara. And it's, he's done this, it's a rainy season, and the roads are all muddy, and there's a big puddle in front of Dipankara Buddha, and Sumedha has thrown himself down on the ground so that the Buddha Dipankara won't get his feet wet walking on the road. And then Dipankara Buddha says, please get up, ascetic. The Buddhas do not tread on living beings. So Sumedha the yogi gets up and then makes this aspiration that he wishes to realize Buddhahood for the sake of all beings. And then Dipankara says, yes indeed, and your aspiration will be fulfilled, and in four incalculable periods and 100,000 eons time you will be the Buddha Gautama. And so that was when the Buddha of our current age, Gautama Buddha, made his aspiration and determination to be a Bodhisattva. So I've been just been reading this in this book, and I thought, well, that's a bit cheeky. I mean, I know he's a Leo, but that's a little bit over the top, even. And so anyway, I thought, well, I better just sit on this for a while. I was being an extremely junior monk, way at the back of the ranks at the time. So it happened that a few months later, I went down to Chidhurst Monastery where he was living, and this was all before Amavati had opened up. So I went down there, and we were on an arms round, walking together. Through the country lanes, and I thought, well, this seems about the right kind of moment to bring it up. There's no one else around, I don't want to embarrass him in public. And I said, Tanajan, I realize where you got the name for Amaravati from. And he said, oh yes. And I said, oh yeah, well, I was reading a story about the history of the Buddha Dipankara. And he said, what? Well, you know, during the lifetime of the Buddha Dipankara, when Gautama Buddha first made his aspiration to attain Buddhahood. What? And he stopped walking. And I said, well, it says, four incalculable periods and 100,000 years ago, there was a Brahmin called Sumedha who lived in the city of Amaravati. And he went absolutely white. And he looked at me. I didn't know. They both stood there and looked at each other for a while. Oh. Right. So then he felt a little bit embarrassed. So whenever we've mentioned that on any of our publications, we've always kind of put a little footnote. So he wasn't aware that a name was chosen. Anyway, this verse was when Amaravati Monastery was first opened, and for many years, he always liked to bring up this teaching and to quote this verse from the Dhammapada. My heedfulness is the path to the deathless. Heedlessness is the path to death. The heedful never die. The heedless are as if dead already. And would often use that as a theme, a central theme for his teaching. So it's a potent verse. There's a lot in it, and it very strikes very deep within the heart. The statement, like the heedful never die, the mindful never die, the heedless eyes is dead already. That's kind of threatening. Like, which side am I on? What do I count as? And just that phrase, to say that the heedful never die. That's very striking thing to say. That if you're one who is mindful, heedful, awake person, then you never die. What does that mean? Does it mean your body never dies? Do you just live forever? Well, the Buddha certainly passed away. Yeah. All the other great enlightened disciples that you hear, they seem to have all gone. So what can this mean? Well, there's a couple of different ways that we can think about death, or we can relate to the word death in a psychological sense and in a physical sense. But in a way, the teaching applies accurately and validly in both respects. So when we talk about death on a psychological level, this is where this is like we would say, like dying on stage or dying socially, being socially dead. That it's where we say invest our heart in something, and we experience death in terms of wanting to be a success and then failing, wanting to be accepted and then being rejected, wanting to be attractive and then finding yourself unattractive. Basically, the way that we can invest the heart into some aspect of our body, our personality, our working world, our relationships, our family life, anything of that nature. Identified with being a young person and then getting wrinkles, being short-sighted, wearing bifocals. That young person has died. A very common example is being divorced. It's like a death experience. The marriage has died. Or a breakup of a romance. Something which we invest our heart in then comes to an end. It breaks up, it finishes, it dissolves. And so then we experience that heartbreak, that loss. We can call that ego death or psychological death. That can be a very valid way of talking about it. So then say the heedless is this dead already. It's like saying when we're heedless, we're constantly dying in this way. We're constantly investing the heart in different things, different aspects of ourself, our character, our work, our living situation, our relationships with other people, our relationships with the world, all kinds of different ways. And so we're constantly dying because we keep being born. We keep getting born into this hope and that idea and this project and this feeling and this season. And then with every birth, then as it lives, it goes through its cycle. There's birth and then there's maturation and fruition and then degeneration and dissolution and death. Just that's the way nature is. Just walking through the forest path between my kuti, my cabin, and down here every day, just walking on all the dead leaves and the busted acorns that didn't make it. Here we're walking on the bodies of the dead. The last year's leaves. We don't relate to it in the same way as the ground littered with my failures, or the my rejection slips, and all the kind of records of everything that has fallen apart, or I've done wrong, or every shortcoming of my character or personality or relationship. But when we look, we're seeing a death is around us everywhere. It's normal. But we don't feel I don't tend to feel a sense of heartbreak seeing last year's oak leaf lying on the path or an acorn that's split open and cracked. I don't find that painful in my heart. But when I remember some incident where I said something that was stupid or foolish or related to somebody that made them dislike me or was hurtful to them or made them afraid of me or irritated with me, then those are definitely not oak leaves. All of the the kind of screw-ups and mistakes and bad behavior and foolish words and social collapses, they're definitely not as neutral as dead oak leaves and the twigs and the litter of the forest. We because of the heart having been born into those things, then we feel it very differently. Just as if, you know, if we were heavily identified with the the trees and so forth, we might feel that same kind of pain, you know, with the change of the season and the leaves falling off the trees and so forth. But generally, we're not so identified in that kind of way. So we can talk about death. We can relate to this idea of being dead already or constantly dying. When we look at the terrain of our lives, our experience in this way, when it says the mindful never die, the heedful never die, when we're really attentive, when we watch closely, we watch our emotions, we watch the pattern of our reactions and our relationships, the way that we function in contact with other people, in our work, in our families, the people that we live with, the people that we encounter in casual contact, just relating to our past and our future, the memories that arise or the plans that we have, the whole array, the spectrum of different experiences, those that were beautiful and glorious, those that are painful and difficult, and a huge mass that are just sort of mundane and somewhere in the middle. When we're truly heedful, when there's a real attention and a reflective wisdom brought to bear on the whole range of our experience, then we don't die. We don't get born into things. We don't find ourselves just endlessly replaying the past triumphs and glories and delights and getting carried away with them, or endlessly replaying the crises and miseries and crack-ups. You know, when those arise, you know, memories of the past or ideas, hopes, fears for the future, we recognize the bitter taste, the sweet taste, the neutral taste that come. Well, that's a bitter memory when that comes to mind, when I was in that place at that time with those people. Yeah, it just didn't work out. When that comes to mind, it's like a sourness. I don't want to pay attention to that. I want to get away from that memory. When something else comes to mind, well, that was really great. Wow, that was really something. It's a sweet taste. That's a real delight. But we find that if we're mindful, if we're really attentive, we can taste the sweetness without getting carried away by it. Similarly, in the present moment, we can just witness the different experiences that we have, the beauties and the uglinesses that we perceive, the bitterness and the sweetness of life, the things that arise in us, the kind of judgments that we make, the opinions that we have about ourselves, you know, the things that arise within us, judging our actions, you know, our successes or our shortcomings or our qualities, good or bad, or judging other people, the things that arise within our own hearts, you know, this person's good, that person's no good, this one drives me nuts, this one terrifies me, this one's a moron, this one, oh, you know, he's really, really incredibly impressive, etc., etc. It's not, when we talk about awakening or enlightenment, we talk about, say, being truly heedful in this way. We're not neutralizing, we're not trying to sterilize experience so that we just I'm not trying to kind of feel or sense anything at all. But it's that quality, the capacity that we have within the heart to know what arises, to know preferences, to know impressions and reactions, and to not be fooled by them, so that when something arises whereby we feel an irritation, you know, pain in the body, or we see someone that that we had an argument with, or we find their manner of being or certain aspects of the way they function, arouses irritation. It's just plain annoying. But we're not negating that or trying to wipe that out. But just recognize, no, that's when I see that person, I feel irritation. There's a judgment that happens. When I see that person, and when I think of them, then I feel fear. I feel attraction or excitement. I feel inspiration. So this is what I mean by not dying. Because we're not born into those feelings of judgment, those opinions or attractions or aversions. We're able to witness those character traits, and those are the results of, you know,